This week, as we gather with friends and family to give thanks to God, take some time to remember those pilgrims and Indians at that first Thanksgiving. The pilgrims risked much to come to America, and half of them died that first winter. Their dependence on God and their friendship with the Indians, who taught them how to farm and hunt in America, helped them through that difficult first year, and they gave thanks for the harvest. Likewise, we give thanks to God for His rich blessings.
Welcome to The Lighthouse, a ministry of Covenant Tabernacle World Outreach Center. And now for today's message, here's Associate Pastor Brian Longworth.
We are continuing our sermon series entitled Critical Race Theory, Is Slavery America's Original Sin? And in looking at this topic, we have, first of all, looked at two principles. One from John chapter 8, verses 31 and 32. Jesus said, "If you abide in my word, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." So it's important that we are first basing all of our beliefs on the word of God, that we're reading the Bible, that we're abiding in it, living in it, meditating upon it, memorizing it, and doing this on a continuous basis so that we would know the truth, so that the truth would set us free. Also from Romans chapter 1, we know that there are some who know the truth but suppress the truth in unrighteousness. So especially when we look at what people are saying, what we are basing our opinion on, especially in a case of an event that we weren't there, or an event in history where obviously we weren't there, in past history, it is important that we look to individuals and organizations that love the truth, even if it doesn't fit their narrative. One of the sources that we have looked at quite a bit is actually David Barton and Wall Builders. Now, we're going to reference today a book called Democracy in America by Alex de Tocqueville. And that book is said to have, or Alex de Tocqueville is said to have said that America is great because America serves God, something to that effect. And if America ever ceases to serve God, then America will cease to be great. And although that quote is quoted by many conservatives, by many who believe in that the founders of this country did love God, many of them loved God, or the majority of them did at least. But many people who hold to that will actually use that quote as proof that we need to turn to God in America. Yet Wall Builders, if you look up that quote on Wall Builders, they actually list that quote as an unverified quote, even though it supports their worldview. And they believe the content or the essence of what is said there, they can't attribute it to de Tocqueville because they can't find it in any written account that de Tocqueville actually said that. So they are an organization that, and by the way, we've mentioned they own about 120,000 documents from America's founding era. On the flip side, you have the 1619 Project. The 1619 Project is actually a part of the New York Times. Nicole Hannah Jones actually looked at the 1619 Project, and she says, well, in 1619, the first slaves arrived in America, and since that time, everything that has been accomplished in America has been on the backs of slaves. Now, we've shown from previous sermons, and you can go to our church website, covenanttabernacle.com, our church Facebook page, Covenant Tabernacle World Outreach Center, and also our church YouTube channel, and you can watch some of those past sermons, and you can see, but we have actually shown that first slave ship was not brought here with the intent of enslaving people in America. There was actually a Portuguese slave ship that was captured by British who brought it ashore in Virginia, The slaves were actually made indentured servants, were later released and given land and given the opportunity to live as free men. One of those former slaves who was made an indentured servant, who was given his freedom, became quite wealthy, was bringing other slaves over to America, making them indentured servants. He had one lazy indentured servant, and he sued for the right to own him. And that's where slavery actually started, a black man from Africa suing to own another black man. But we're going to look at some history today. We actually started last week talking about a book called from Thomas Sowell called Black Rednecks and White Liberals. It's quite a name for a book, but also the content of this book is significant because he really shows how a lot of the behavior of the slaves and of the blacks that had been in slavery was actually learned behavior from the whites, including what we know today as Ebonics, that slang English where certain letters aren't pronounced properly. You say axe instead of axe. You use various slang that actually was spoken by the slave owners before they came to America. So you start to see some of the behaviors that we still see. By the way, the rednecks that owned slaves, they were called rednecks before they came to America, but they actually grew past that, and many of the slaves grew past that. But in the inner city, in the poorest inner city blacks, we do see some of those same characteristics. And so I would encourage you to check out this book and also to review last Sunday's sermon. But we're going to look at the economy, because the 1619 Project does say one of their tenets is that every economic success that we have, all the wealth that we have in this country, is because of slavery and due to slavery. And the facts of the matter actually do not bear that out. In fact, many of the contemporaries in the slave era, and many of those that wrote about the slave era and compared the North and the South, actually said, including, by the way, Alexis de Tocqueville in his Democracy in America, and also Frederick Law Olmsted in his book Cotton Country, many of those who wrote about that time actually wrote about how poor the South was and how held back the South was. And many, including Alexis de Tocqueville and Frederick Law Olmsted, actually pointed to the institution of slavery as the cause of this retardation of the economy in the South. Thomas Sowell actually claims that wasn't slavery as important of a big of an impact on the South as slavery was, that the behaviors of the slave owners was something that they held before they came to America, long before there was ever a black slave. Even when they came to America, they still had these habits. And going back to what we talked about yesterday, or it's going to be last Sunday, when we look at this, what we see is that, first of all, these people came from an area where there was no centralized form of government, and they needed to be willing to defend themselves, to defend their families, to defend their honor. And so education was not very important, not looked at as very important in that society. industriousness, business, being and investing time into building a business was not looked at as very important. What was looked at being very important was manliness, being willing to exert how manly you were, because if you were known as being manly, if you were known as someone who would beat someone up that messed with you, well, it was more likely that people wouldn't actually mess with you. And this is what was important and what was valued. Now, those people, when they came to America, they brought that mentality with them. They actually looked for the joy of the moment as opposed to investing for the future. Observers of the white population in the antebellum South often commented, and this is from Thomas Sowell's Black Rednecks and White Liberals, often commented not only on their poverty, but their lack of industriousness or entrepreneurship. A contemporary characterized many white Southerners as too poor to own slaves and too proud to work. There was actually a South Carolina, he was either a senator or a member of the House of Representatives, that said that the Southerners were too proud to do menial work. Robert E. Lee, the general from the Civil War, actually talked about how difficult it was to get the men, the soldiers, to actually do things that were industrious. But a contemporary characterized many white Southerners as too poor to own slaves and too proud to work. A landmark history of agriculture in the antebellum South described the poor whites this way. They cultivated in a casual and careless fashion small patches of corn or rice, sweet potatoes, cowpeas, and garden products. Women and children did a large part of it. The men spent their time predominantly in hunting or idleness. The men were inveterate drunkards, and sometimes the women joined them in drinking inferior whiskey. Licentiousness was prevalent among them. Among their equals, the men were quarrelsome and inclined to crimes of violence. The poor whites were densely ignorant. Their labors tended to be intermittent, often when they were pressed for money rather than a steady employment career. Frederick Law Olmsted called it lazy poverty, with whatever work they did being done in a thoughtless manner. Summarizing his observation in the antebellum South, Olmsted said, "I know that men seldom want an abundance of coarse food in cotton states. The proportion of free white men who live as well in any aspect as our working class in the North on average is small, and that the citizens of the cotton states as a whole are poor. They work little, and that little badly. They earn little, they sell little, they buy little, and they have little, very little of the common comforts and consolations of civilized life. Their destitution is not material only, it is intellectual and it is moral." One of the things that is interesting when you compare the South to the North is they actually in the North actually had four times more schools, four times more students that attended those schools. And as recent as World War I, blacks from the North, black soldiers from the North, tested better on scholastic tests in the armed forces than did whites from the South. And so you can see that education wasn't a huge, huge important role, neither was being industrious. When Olmsted found work done effectively, efficiently, promptly and well during his travels through the South, when he found well-run businesses, good libraries, impressive churches, and efficiently functioning organizations in general, he almost invariably found them to be run by foreigners, foreigners, or Jews. Nor was he the only visiting observer to reach such conclusions. Another observed that nearly all of the successful storekeepers were either Yankees or Yankee-trained Southerners. A French visitor said that when he saw a plantation in better condition than others, he would often find that it was owned by someone from the North. A history of Southern agriculture presented this picture of North Carolina in the 18th century. Many of the inhabitants were rough borderers who lived in a crude, half-savage existence. Some were herdsmen who depended mainly on the range and under the necessity of eating meat without bread. Why did they not eat bread? Well, because they weren't growing wheat. That's why they didn't eat bread. There were also many thriftless and lazy families who had been attracted to the country by the mild climate and an ease with which a bare livelihood could be obtained by hunting and fishing, raising a little corn, keeping a few herd of swine, and possibly a cow or two on the range. Observers saw the difference when they could go down the Ohio River, and they said you could actually look at the Ohio side versus the Kentucky side and see a stark difference. The Kentucky side would not be as prosperous, but the Ohio side would be much more prosperous. In 1860, the South had actually 40% of the milk cows, but produced only 20% of the butter and only 1% of the cheese. So they were constantly importing cheese, importing butter, sometimes importing butter from as far away as Ireland to satisfy their needs. And one of the things that Frederick Law Olmsted talked about is he talked about how rare it was to find butter. Many of the plantation owners had actually never tasted butter. They had heard of it, but they hadn't actually tasted it. And many of those who had milk cows, what they would do, they would actually milk them so little as to only provide enough for their own family, even though butter and cheese were actually in demand. And they were actually looking for this. They could have made money, but they were too lazy to do so. You look at some of the things that happened. They had rich deposits of coal, yet they imported coal from other from the North. They had rich deposits of granite, yet they imported granite from Europe. One of the things was up north, if a landowner had a small creek on his property, he would go out with another man and they would build a bridge over that. Not in the South. In the South, they would forge the creek, forge the river. In fact, it was said that a landowner in the South that had a creek would forge it for the rest of his life rather than build a bridge over it. Thomas Jefferson, from coming to his home area, from coming from Monticello to Washington, D.C., had to forge 8 rivers. And this is something, this was commonplace back then because of laziness. And people from, farmers from the North, if they had a tree in the middle of their farmland, they would cut the tree down. They would get rid of not only the tree, but also the stump, people in the farmers in the South would just plow around the stump. They might not even cut the tree down. They might just harness it so that it actually dies, but just leave it to rot. And some people said, well, you know, they don't produce as much in the South because of the lack of productivity of the land. Yet there were Northerners that came down to the South that actually did quite well down there. They also, another example of this is when a horse died, and if the Southerner owned the horse, the Southerner wouldn't bother to skin it. The Southerner would actually sell the horse to someone else who would skin it and sell its hide and its skin for at a profit. And this, by the way, Thomas Sowell points out that this was not because the Southerners didn't know how to skin, because before they came to America, one of their common practices was that when they would kill their enemies, because that's the way they lived, they would actually kill their enemies, they would skin their enemies, and they would adorn their houses with the skin of their enemies. He also points out that it wasn't really that they were lazy. It was just that they didn't employ or didn't focus on business and didn't focus on doing the necessary things so that they could actually prosper, because they spent an enormous amount of energy in dance. They spent an enormous amount of energy hunting, and also in their fighting. They were very aggressive physically, yet when it came to actually spending their time to actually be productive and actually earn money, that was not something that they actually looked at and did. So one of the things that we talked about last week is the generational curses, and it's really a sad thing when you see this, and we can all know when you actually, you know, we all have seen examples of people that commit the same sins over and over again, and many times their children commit those same sins and their children commit those same sins. And so what you see here is that the people, the slave owners, coming to America with certain bad habits and then giving those habits to their children and eventually giving those to slaves. And we see that the descendants of the slaves, to some extent, some of the descendants of slaves today in the inner city, we see some of the bad habits that were actually originally from the slave owners prior to them even coming to America. In Exodus chapter 20, verses 4 through 6, we read, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." And what is needed today when we talk about race and race relationships, what is needed is not that we talk about really. And certainly we need to know that what happened with slavery, whether the slave was a black man owning a black man, or a white man owning a black man, or a black man owning a white man, or a white man owning a black white man owning a white man, or an Indian owning another Indian, or owning a black or a white. It really doesn't matter the race. What matters is slavery was wrong. And also, we need to realize that the attitudes of the slaveholders, their bad behavior is something that is wrong and actually kept the South poor for a long period of time, and actually also kept slaves poor even after they were given their emancipation. One thing that we do see today among certain segments of the inner city is we do see this still this view that education is a bad thing. I have heard from teachers that sometimes black students will get beat up on the playground if they earn a good grade, and quite often people of black descent in the inner city who speak proper English are derided. I was even one day working at a business for the entire day, and I heard this one young black man speaking perfectly proper English the entire day until the workday ended, when he called one of his homies, and you would have thought he couldn't speak proper English. Why? And I asked a friend and an employee who was black, why was this? And he said, there's a huge amount of pressure to not be white. There's a huge amount of pressure. And so what we need to realize is that there's not a white way of doing things. What we need to realize is that the bad behaviors that we have seen in this country under slavery, and that we see even today in the poorest sections of the inner city, that actually is bad behaviors that were taught to slaves by the slave owners. And what we really need to do is to value education. We need to value doing what is right, living for God, being industrious, being productive, making sure that we can realize that we in this country can work hard, we can succeed, and we can grow and actually even bring ourselves up out of poverty. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Now to him who is able to keep you from stumbling and to present you faultless before the presence of his glory with exceeding joy, to God our Savior, who alone is wise, be glory and majesty, dominion and power, both now and forever. Amen.
You've been listening to The Lighthouse, a ministry of Covenant Tabernacle in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Join us each Sunday morning for The Lighthouse. If you've been blessed by this broadcast, visit www.covenanttabernacle.com, where you can give us feedback and make a donation.
This week, as we gather with friends and family to give thanks to God, take some time to remember those pilgrims and Indians at that first Thanksgiving. The pilgrims risked much to come to America, and half of them died that first winter. Their dependence on God and their friendship with the Indians, who taught them how to farm and hunt in America, helped them through that difficult first year, and they gave thanks for the harvest. Likewise, we give thanks to God for his rich blessings.